So what's the number one problem that I hear people talking about these days? It is direction in life. For there's an epidemic of indecision and uncertainty. It's a concern of teenagers who feel pressured by parents and by teachers to get good grades so that you can get into a good college, so that you can have a good career, and you need to choose that career now, up front. And then for young adults, whom sociologists have labeled, those born between 1965 and 1979, as the postponed generation. That is, compared to parents and grandparents before, they're making much later decisions about career, about marriage, about buying a house, about children, postponing major decisions. And the best explanation seems to be that there's so many alternatives, so many options, that there's a paralysis of choosing any one for fear of what will then be missed out upon by not selecting those. It's a recurring theme in midlife. For those in midlife often have this chronic restlessness that comes from getting older and feeling that something is being missed. That when the successes of life are achieved, they're not all that satisfying or fulfilling. In many cases, it was more fun trying to get there than actually arriving. And so there are a lot of career changes at midlife. There are two physicians in Wisconsin, a husband and wife, who simultaneously resigned both of their practices and went together into a new business venture of a bagel shop, a career change. Or the professor out west who told me at 46 years old that even though he has a PhD and is well published and successful and renowned in his career, he's thinking about instead becoming a business consultant. Although he's never been in business and he's never before consulted with anyone. But he's wondering, what would it be like to get to the end of life and never to have tried what maybe was the one thing that he was meant to do? Retirees often wonder if their lives have really counted for something. I talked recently at lunch with a former professor of mine, a man whom, in my own 30 years of formal education, may be the best classroom teacher I ever had. And he was wondering if he had done a very good job, and whether his life had counted for anything, and whether he had in any way achieved or succeeded in his teaching career. And I suppose that it is in significant part that all of us see that we have one shot at life, and we don't want to blow it. We want our lives to matter. We want our lives to make a difference. We want to be able to leave a mark. We want to be able to know why we were here and what we have accomplished and hope that somehow we have succeeded. There is a story in the biography of Jesus that I think can help us. It's about Jesus' life, and it's a good Labor Day story because it's about Jesus, not only who he is, but what he did, how he lived. A story that helps us learn for ourselves what are some of the marks of a God-directed life. I'd like you to hear the story. If you use your own Bible, it's in Luke 13, verses 31 to 35. Or if you prefer to use the Blue Pew Bible in front of you, then I suggest you open it to page 1621 and then listen. At that time, some Pharisees came to Jesus and said to him, "Leave this place, go somewhere else. Herod wants to kill you." Jesus replied, "Go tell that fox, I will drive out demons and heal people today and tomorrow, and on the third day I will reach my goal. In any case, I must keep going. Keep going today and tomorrow and the next day, for surely no prophet can die outside Jerusalem." Oh, Jerusalem. Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate, and I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" From Jesus' life, we see that the first mark of a God-directed life is to know the goal. That makes sense. If you don't know the goal, if you don't know where you're going, then how can you make the individual decisions that will get you to that destination? Jesus knew. He knew where he was going to the point that he could say in verse 32, "This is what I've got planned for the next 3 days. I will drive out demons and heal people today and tomorrow, and on the third day, I will reach my goal." So he has this clear sense of goal that helped him through what in this case, and surely in other cases as well, were difficult decisions to make. It's interesting that Jesus clearly distinguished between long and short-term goals. He knew that his long-term goal was to do the will of the Father. That is, that his long-term goal was to die on the cross, to atone for human sin. But he also knew what he was supposed to do for the next 24, 48, 72 hours. That he was supposed to heal people, and he was supposed to chase out demons. Now, on this goal business, I think it is very much the same with us. That if we want God-directed lives, then we need to have God goals. But I will tell you what we typically do. We struggle day in and day out trying to get the big goal at the end of life that we're supposed to accomplish. This is the big deal. And neglect the 1 and 2 and 3 day goals because we assume that the ultimate goal will determine what is immediate. And in some cases, that is absolutely true. But we need to learn something from this page of Jesus' biography, that it may be altogether possible that we do what is right for the goals of today and tomorrow and Tuesday, and that is the means by which we will know and that we will discover and live out the far greater goals within our lives. It is to have this sense of God goals within the immediate and not just the long term. The second mark of a God-directed life is to do what God asks, for certainly that's what Jesus did. He was sensitive to God's present expectations. In this case, what God was asking him to do was to chase out demons and to heal sick people. I think a lot about this whole business of our doing what God asks, and I'm intrigued by observing other people's lives so that I can learn, frankly, mostly for myself. And so I've taken on a personal hobby of late, where I have sought out Christians whom I consider people who have lived good and godly and meaningful lives and are now in their 70s, 80s, 90s. And I like to interview them. Don't always tell them they're being interviewed, just sort of sneak these questions in along the way. One of the questions I ask is, what were your goals and objectives 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago? And then, how does life compare the way things turned out to the way you had things planned? Now, admittedly, my sample here is very small. I've done this with a few dozen people, and so I may have missed the main point. But so far, at least, I haven't found anyone for whom life turned out as they planned. No one. Now, again, maybe that's the exception. But what I have been repeatedly told is that they had plans for life, and along came stunning opportunities that they never anticipated. Never in their wildest dream did they imagine that these things could be possible. They also tell me that there have been devastating disappointments. That there were times in life when they actually wrote out a plan and this is what they were going to do, and never did they imagine that life would be like a minefield with explosions occurring not only around them but under them. And so life does not turn out quite the way it was anticipated. But then, I think without exception, they begin to detail how God has brought all of these pieces together in unanticipated ways, in ways that at the time did not make sense to them, nor did they really understand. But now, from the vantage point later in life, they can see the sense of it. And what I see most in them is their willingness to do whatever God asked them to do at that point in life. So when they took new jobs or when they lost old jobs or when a child was born or when a spouse died, when all of these things happened in life, that they were obedient to what God asked them to do at that moment in that situation, even though it didn't even make sense. But that later it did. And when they could not see the hand of God in the moment, they could see the hand of God and how the mosaic of their lives was all woven together. And so what I've learned, or I've been trying to learn from these senior Christians, is to do whatever God asks that I do at the time, and to worry less than I have otherwise worried about how it all hangs together. It is to follow the pattern of Jesus, who took 1, 2, 3 days at a time and leave the rest to God, because that is one of the marks of a God-directed life. The third mark of a God-directed life is a willingness to die for what is right. You know that there are those who say, if you don't know what you're willing to die for, then you will never figure out what you need to live for. Jesus was headed to Jerusalem to die. In a sense, that was the goal of his whole life. He was born for that purpose, to die. That's why he said, I must keep going today and tomorrow and the next day, for surely no prophet can die outside Jerusalem. So he was driven by this labor of love that would take him eventually to the cross. And then that controlled everything else that was in his life along the way. The willingness to die for what is right was a characteristic that Jesus passed to his followers. You may not know that 11 of Jesus' 12 disciples died from other than natural causes. Many of them died terrible, terrible deaths as martyrs. They would rather die than compromise what was right. And that was a trait that was passed along to the next generation as well. I have long been fascinated by the second century Christian leader Polycarp, who was the bishop of Smyrna. That was in the Roman province of Asia, which today is Western Turkey. In the year AD 155, there was a persecution that was sweeping that part of the empire, and an especially vigilant proconsul who was exacting terrible tolls upon the Christian community. And so he ordered his soldiers to seek out and to arrest Polycarp, the 100-year-old bishop of Smyrna, and brought this dear old man into the center of a Colosseum-like arena where a bloodthirsty crowd was screaming out for his death. The proconsul, touched with a fleeting moment of compassion, silenced the crowd and made an offer to this old man. He suggested that he curse the Christ and live. So Polycarp had an opportunity here to decide whether he was willing to curse Jesus Christ and live, or do what was right, and that is remain loyal to Jesus Christ and die. Polycarp, in what is a well-documented history of the conversation, answered and said, 86 years have I served him, and he has done me no wrong. How then can I blaspheme my king who saved me? The proconsul said, Polycarp, I can order out the wild beast to attack and eat you. And the 100-year-old man said, bring out the lions. The proconsul said, Polycarp, I can order the executioners to build a pyre of wood and have you burned at the stake. And the old man said, light the fire. And they did. They put him on a post in the center of a pyre. Just before they lit it, they brought out the hammer and nails to nail him to the post so that he wouldn't run away from the flames, which would be what someone with natural instinct would do. Polycarp said, you don't need the nails. I will stand here to die. And so without the nails, they lit the fire, and there Polycarp died. He had a God-directed life where he was willing to do what was right, willing to die to do what was right. Now, the chances are close to zero that any of us would ever face anything so dramatic. But that doesn't mean that the principle doesn't apply to us. In fact, you could argue that the principle is all the more applicable in more routine situations. To hold on to what is right, to the point where you'd be willing to lose your job rather than do what is wrong. To do what is right, even if it means breaking off a relationship that is dear to you. That you're willing to do what is right, even if it means losing a business contract that is very important to you and others, and you have invested the last 6 months of your life into it. For the real question is, are we absolutely committed to do what is right for God, regardless of the consequences? It is a mark of the God-directed life to be willing to die or do whatever else is needed for what is right. The fourth mark of a God-directed life is that it is undeterred by human threats. In Jesus' case, it was Herod, the king of Galilee, and it was the Pharisees who came and gave him warning that they apparently had gotten from some insider in Herod's palace. So they told Jesus, leave this place and go somewhere else because Herod wants to kill you. Now, that's a threat I would take seriously because Herod had proved that he would carry out his threats. Herod was a despot. He was virtually an absolute monarch, at least in that area called Galilee. He had already taken Jesus' relative and friend, the prophet John the Baptist, arrested and put him in prison, and on a whim, had his head cut off and delivered on a platter at a state banquet. So let there be no doubt that he would follow through on his threat. Jesus, however, would not bend to the threat of this man. It's just amazing. And the lesson for us is especially to those of us who may be tempted to live our lives continually responding to threats. They get a threatening phone call or an intimidating letter, or somebody who's just very bossy and pushy and exerting pressure to compromise. And then we all have to decide if we are going to go by the direction of God on the inside or the threats of other people that are on the outside. The person who is God-directed on the inside does what is right no matter how anyone, threatening or otherwise, behaves on the outside. This summer, I heard an interesting story about a young man who decided he wanted to become a missionary. And so he applied to an organization, and part of the application process was that he had to go through an interview, and the interviewer that was appointed was himself a retired missionary. This interviewer contacted the young applicant and told him to show up at his home at 5 a.m. for the interview. It was a snowy winter day, and he came, arrived at 5 o'clock in the morning, but the retired missionary did not greet him at the door, instead had someone else usher him into another room where he sat alone without any explanation for 3 hours. Sort of like waiting for a plane, you know, that's been delayed. And at the end of 3 hours, the interviewer, the retired missionary, walked into the room and started this way. Can you spell? He said, yes, sir. He said, then spell Baker. So he said, B-A-K-E-R. He said, can you do numbers? He said, yes, sir. He said, all right, I want you to add 2 plus 2. And the young applicant said, 4. He said, that's fine. You may go now. I'll turn in my report. Let me just say, if that had happened to me, if I were the candidate, I would consider that to be threatening and inappropriate behavior. Not quite the risk of execution, but at least intimidating, and I wouldn't have liked it. But let me tell you what happened. The next day, the examiner met with the board of this mission organization and gave his report. Here's the report. He has all the qualifications to be a missionary. First, I tested him on self-denial, making him arrive at my house at 5 a.m. He left a warm bed and came out in the snow without any complaint. Second, I tested him on promptness. He arrived on time. Third, I examined him on patience. I made him wait 3 hours to see me. Fourth, I tested him on temper. He failed to show any sign of aggravation or anger at the delay. Fifth, I tested him on humility by asking him questions that a 7-year-old child could answer, and he showed no indignation. So, you see, I believe the candidate meets the requirements. He will make the missionary that we need. What I would say is that this young Christian was God-directed on the inside rather than shaped by human threats on the outside. He was a whole lot like Jesus. The fifth mark of a God-directed life is that it is unchanged by group pressure. And this is different, by the way. Different than the threats that come from somebody who is in authority. These are the peers. These are friends. These are people probably well-meaning. These are people that we know, that we hang out with. In Jesus' case, it was some friendly Pharisees. And by the way, you read Jesus' biography and you find that most Pharisees were not friendly with Jesus. They usually had an adversarial relationship between them. But these Pharisees apparently liked Jesus. They didn't like Herod. They got this information. They gave him the warning. They said, Herod's going to kill you. What you need to do is get out of Galilee. Leave town, because if you get outside of Herod's jurisdiction, then he won't be able to harm you. Except Jesus was set on his God-given goals. He knew what he was supposed to do for the next 3 days. And he was not going to take a vote, he was not going to take a poll, he was not going to make his decision on the basis of well-meaning people around him who were pressuring him to run away. And you just get this sense that Jesus had this gyroscope spinning inside him, that when other people bumped against him to go their direction, he was still able to keep his equilibrium. You sense that Jesus has this internal compass that has a true north of God's direction in his life. And when other people, even with magnetic personalities, try to pull the needle around in another direction, that Jesus always is able to stay focused, God-directed, on that true north of what God wants. It's amazing. It's wonderful. Now recognize that there are two extremes that we people tend to go to. The one extreme is that some of us just flip-flop with everyone else's opinion and advice. These are the people who consider God last and other people first. So as soon as somebody says, you ought to do this, well, then maybe I ought to do that. The other extreme, some people stubbornly hold on to their opinions regardless of what other people have to say. They're oblivious to other people's input within their lives. They have little or no sensitivity to other people or to God and are arrogant. Just so self-focused that they won't consider input from any other source. But Jesus was guilty of neither extreme. He listened to other people, he was sensitive to them, but he kept getting his directions from God. He kept on course. He was unchanged by human pressure. And that's the way I want to be. I don't want to be this kind of person who reads whatever is happening, the opinions of everybody else, and then when I figured out what the majority wants, say, oh yeah, that's what I want as well. Instead, I want to be like Jesus, who when God calls me to do something, that's what I do. If I feel like running away and he says, no, you stay and fight, then I'm going to stay and fight. On the other hand, if he's saying, get out of there, and I say, wait a minute, I can deal with this one, I can fight it out, I need to listen and go with what he says, not with the group pressure around me. Do we change? Of course we change, constantly. But it's the changes that God brings in our lives while we are unchanged by group pressure. Last on the list of these marks of a God-directed life is a passion for people. And I want to read to you again the words of Jesus, but I need you to help me because I know I can't do this well. I don't want you to hear the words. I want you to feel the emotions. And I can't get them. I've tried this, and I can feel it, but I can't say it right. So you're going to have to do this. Not that the words are unimportant, but the heart of Jesus in this is extremely important. Jesus says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you were not willing. You were not willing. And so look, your house is left to you desolate. And I tell you, you will not see me again until you finally say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. In there is this passion of Jesus for people. He loved these people. He loved the people of Jerusalem. Even though they stoned the prophets of God, even though they were going to crucify him, he just loved them. He was not selfish. He was not self-absorbed. He focused on the needs of others. He wanted the very best for these people, even when they repeatedly did not want God's best for themselves. He wept over Jerusalem and the people, and he never gave up. And we begin to realize that one of the clearest marks of the God-directed person is that that person has a passion for people. You can't be directed by God and not have a passion for people. By contrast, that person who is self-concerned, self-absorbed, self-focused, all worried about her needs and what he wants and whether he gets his way, that is the person that usually is not God-directed. And there is, I will tell you, a strange irony here, that there are people who so fill their lives with figuring out what they're supposed to do and the direction they're supposed to go that they don't have time for anybody else, and all of life is spent with an aimlessness, a wandering around, a missing out. Or by contrast, there are those people who get outside of themselves and are not so concerned about how they look or what other people think. They are focused upon others. They have this passion for people. And here's the irony, that in the discovery of the passion for people is when they find their own God-given purpose and direction in life. It's when, in a sense, they're not seeking it that they most find it. It's when we are so subject to God and God's attitude toward others that we discover God's direction for our own selves. Now, this is Labor Day weekend, and in our culture, it is when we are supposed to be most thoughtful on the third of the three most frequently asked questions in our culture. And those questions are, what is your name, where you're from, and what do you do? And I've wondered, if Jesus slipped into our culture, how he would answer them. He would say, I am Jesus of Nazareth, and what I do, and he could answer legitimately. I make furniture. I'm a carpenter. I was apprenticed in my own father's shop in Nazareth. Or he could say, I am Jesus of Nazareth, and I am a teacher. I teach in the synagogues and out in the streets and on the hillsides. I teach people the truths about God. But I think if he were framing the words most directly, and he was sure that we could understand, he would say, I am Jesus of Nazareth, and I live for God. Now, the way I do that is in the furniture that I make. The way I do that is in the lessons that I teach. But that's not what I do. What I do is I live for God. He had this clear sense of direction and purpose. And that's what he wants for us. So go for it. Be like Jesus. Be the kind of person who knows the goal, who knows what God wants, who is willing to die for what is right, who is undeterred by human threats, unchanged by group pressure, and has a passion for other people. God, that's what we want. We want to be like Jesus. We want you to direct our lives. And so we seek to be like your Son.